CD4.
Tripwire by Lee Child. The first defaulter was a big guy. Savage, ferocious, pretty much subnormal in the head. Hobie smiled. Forgave him his debt and wrote it off. Suggested that he might repay this generosity by getting alongside him and taking on the role of enforcer. There were no more defaulters after that. The exact method of deterrence was tricky to establish. A broken arm or leg just sent the guy way back behind the lines to the field hospital, where he was safe and surrounded by white nurses who would probably put out if he came up with some kind of heroic description about how he got the injury. A bad break might even get him invalided out of the service altogether and returned stateside. No kind of deterrence in that. No kind of deterrence at all. So Hobie had his enforcer use pungee spikes. They were a VC invention, a small sharp wooden spike like a meat skewer, coated with buffalo dung, which is poisonous. The VC concealed them in shallow holes, so GIs would step on them and get septic crippling wounds in the feet. Hobie's enforcer aimed to use them through the defaulter's testicles. The feeling among Hobie's clientele was the long-term medical consequences were not worth risking, even in exchange for escaping the debt and getting out of uniform. By the time he got burned and lost his arm, Hobie was a seriously rich man. His next coup was to get the whole of his fortune home, undetected and complete. Not everybody could have done it. Not in the particular set of circumstances he found himself in. It was further proof of his greatness, as was his subsequent history. He arrived in New York after a circuitous journey, crippled and disfigured, and immediately felt at home. Manhattan was a jungle, no different from the jungles of Indochina, so there was no reason for him to start acting any different, no reason to change his line of business. And this time, he was starting out with a massive capital reserve. He wasn't starting out with nothing. He loan-sharked for years. He built it up huge. He had the capital, and he had the image. The burn scars and the hook meant a lot visually. He attracted a raft of helpers. He fed off whole identifiable waves and generations of immigrants and poor people. He fought off the Italians to stay in business. He paid off whole squads of cops and prosecutors to stay invisible. Then he made his second great breakthrough. Similar to the first, it was a process of deep radical thought, a response to a problem. The problem was the sheer insane scale. He had millions on the street, but it was all nickel and dime, thousands of separate deals, $100 here, 150 there, 9 or 10% a week, 500 or 1,000% a year. Big paperwork, big hassles, running fast all the time just to keep up. Then he suddenly realized less could be more. It came to him in a flash. 5% of some corporation's $1 million was worth more in a week than 500% of street-level shit. He got in a fever about it. He froze all new lending and turned the screws to get back everything he was owed. He bought suits and rented office space. Overnight, he became a corporate lender. It was an act of pure genius. He had sniffed out that gray margin that lies just to the left of conventional commercial practice. He'd found a huge constituency of borrowers who were just slipping off the edge of what the banks called acceptable. A huge constituency, a desperate constituency, above all a soft constituency. Soft targets, civilized men in suits coming to him for $1 million, posing much less of a risk than somebody in a dirty undershirt wanting $100 in a filthy tenement block with a rabid dog behind the door. Soft targets, easy to intimidate. Unaccustomed to the harsh realities of life, he let his enforcers go and sat back and watched as his clientele shrank to a handful. His average loan increased a millionfold, his interest rates dropped back into the stratosphere, and his profits grew bigger than he could ever imagine. Less is more. It was a wonderful new business to be in. There were occasional problems, of course, but they were manageable. He changed his deterrence tactic. These civilized new borrowers were vulnerable through their families, wives, daughters, sons. Usually the threat was enough. Occasionally, action had to be taken. Often it was fun. Soft suburban wives and daughters could be amusing, an added bonus, a wonderful business, achieved through a constant willingness to change and adapt. Deep down, he knew his talent for flexibility was his greatest strength. He had promised himself never ever to forget that fact, which is why he was alone in his inner office up there on the 88th floor, listening to the quiet background sounds of the giant building, thinking hard and changing his mind. 50 miles away to the north, in Pound Ridge, Marilyn Stone was changing her mind, too. She was a smart woman. She knew Chester was in financial trouble. It couldn't be anything else. He wasn't having an affair, she knew that. There are signs husbands give out when they're having affairs, and Chester wasn't giving them out. There was nothing else he could be worried about. So it was financial trouble. Her original intention had been to wait, just to sit tight and wait until the day he finally needed to get it off his chest and told her all about it. She had planned to wait for that day and then step in. She could manage the situation from there on in, however far it went exactly. Debt, insolvency, even bankruptcy. Women are good at managing situations, better than men. She could take the practical steps. She could offer whatever consolation was needed. She could pick her way through the ruins without the ego-driven hopelessness Chester was going to be feeling. But now she was changing her mind. She couldn't wait any longer. Chester was killing himself with worry, so she was going to have to go ahead and do something about it. No use talking to him. His instinct was to conceal problems. He didn't want to upset her. He would deny everything and the situation would keep on getting worse, so she had to go ahead and act alone for his sake as well as hers. The obvious first step was to place the house with a realtor. Whatever the exact degree of trouble they were in, selling the house might be necessary. Whether it would be enough, she had no way of telling. It might solve the problem on its own, or it might not. But it was the obvious place to start. A rich woman living in Pound Ridge, like Marilyn, has many contacts in the real estate business. One step down the status ladder, where the women are comfortable without being rich, a lot of them work for realtors. They keep it part-time and try to make it look like a hobby, like it was more connected with an enthusiasm for interior decoration than mere commerce. Marilyn could immediately list 4 good friends she could call. Her hand was resting on the phone as she tried to choose between them. In the end, she chose a woman called Cheryl, who she knew the least well of the 4, but who she suspected was the most capable. She was taking this seriously, and her realtor needed to as well. She dialed the number.
Marilyn, Cheryl answered. How nice to talk to you. Can I help?
Marilyn took a deep breath.
We might be selling the house, she said. And you've come to me. Marilyn, thank you. But why on earth are you guys thinking of selling? It's so lovely where you are. Are you moving out of state?
Marilyn took another deep breath.
I think Chester's going broke. I don't really want to talk about it, but I figure we need to start making contingency plans.
There was no pause, no hesitation, no embarrassment.
I think you're very wise, Cheryl said. Most people hang on way too long, and then they have to sell in a hurry and they lose out.
Most people?
This happens a lot? Are you kidding? We see this all the time. Better to face it early and pick up the true value. You're doing the right thing, believe me. But then women usually do, Marilyn. Because we can handle this stuff better than men, can't we?
Marilyn breathed out and smiled into the phone. Felt like she was doing exactly the right thing, and like this was exactly the right person to be doing it with.
I'll list it right away, Cheryl said. I suggest an asking price $1 short of $2 million and a target of 1.9. That's achievable, and it should spark something pretty quickly.
How quickly?
Today's market, Cheryl said. With your location? 6 weeks? Yeah, so I think we can pretty much guarantee an offer inside 6 weeks.
Dr. McBannerman was still pretty uptight about confidentiality issues, So although she gave up old Mr. and Mrs. Hobie's address, she wouldn't accompany it with a phone number. Jody saw no legal logic in that, but it seemed to keep the doctor happy, so she didn't bother arguing about it. She just shook hands and hustled back through the waiting area and outside to the car, with Reacher following behind her. "Bizarre," she said to him. "Did you see those people in reception?" "Exactly," Reacher replied. "Old people, half dead." "That's what Dad looked like, towards the end. Just like that, I'm afraid. And I guess this old Mr. Hobie won't look any different. So, what were they up to together that people are getting killed over it?" They got into the Bravada together, and she leaned over from the passenger seat and unhooked her car phone. Reacher started the motor to run the air. She dialed information. The Hobies lived north of Garrison, up past Brighton, the next town on the railroad. She wrote their number in pencil on a scrap of paper from her pocketbook and then dialed it immediately. It rang for a long time, and then a woman's voice answered.
"Yes?"
the voice said hesitantly. "Mrs. Hobie?" Jody asked.
"Yes?"
the voice said again, wavering. Jody pictured her, an old, infirm woman, gray, thin, probably wearing a flowery housecoat, gripping an ancient receiver, in an old, dark house smelling of stale food and furniture wax.
"Mrs. Hobie, I'm Jody Garber, Leon Garber's daughter."
"Yes?"
the woman said again.
"He died, I'm afraid, 5 days ago."
"Yes, I know,"
the old woman said. She sounded sad about it.
"Dr. McBannerman's receptionist told us of yesterday's appointment. I was very sorry to hear about it. He was a good man. He was very nice to us. He was helping us. And he told us about you. You're a lawyer. I'm very sorry for your loss."
"Thank you," Jody said. "But can you tell me about whatever it was he was helping you with?"
"Well, it doesn't matter now, does it?"
"Doesn't it?
Why not?" "Well, because your father died,"
the woman said.
"You see, I'm afraid he was really our last hope."
The way she said it, it sounded like she meant it. Her voice was low. There was a resigned fall at the end of the sentence, a sort of tragic cadence, like she'd given up on something long cherished and anticipated. Jody pictured her, a bony hand holding the phone up to her face, a wet tear on a thin, pale cheek.
"Maybe he wasn't," she said. "Maybe I could help you."
There was a silence on the line, just a faint hiss.
"Well, I don't think so," the woman said. "I'm not sure it's the kind of thing a lawyer would normally deal with, you see."
"What kind of thing is it?"
"I don't think it matters now,"
the woman said again.
"Can't you give me some idea?"
"No, I think it's all over now,"
the woman said, like her old heart was breaking. Then there was silence again. Jody glanced out through the windshield at McBannerman's office.
"But how was my father able to help you? Was it something he especially knew about? Was it because he was in the army? Is that what it was? Something connected with the army?"
"Well, yes, it was. That's why I'm afraid you wouldn't be able to help us as a lawyer. We've tried lawyers, you see. We need somebody connected with the army, I think. But thank you very much for offering. It was very generous of you."
"There's somebody else here," Jody said. "He's with me right now. He used to work with my father in the army. He'd be willing to help you out if he can."
There was silence on the line again. Just the same faint hiss and breathing. Like the old woman was thinking, like she needed time to adjust to some new considerations.
"His name is Major Reacher," Jody said into the silence. "Maybe my father mentioned him?"
"They served together for a long time. My father sent for him when he realized he wouldn't be able to carry on any longer." "He sent for him?"
the woman repeated.
"Yes, I think he thought he would be able to come and take over for him. You know, keep on with helping you out."
Was this new person in the military police, too?
Yes, he was. Is that important?
I'm really not sure, the woman said.
She went quiet again. She was breathing close to the phone.
Can he come here to our house? She asked suddenly.
We'll both come, Jody said. Would you like us to come right away? There was silence again, breathing, thinking.
My husband's just had his medication, the woman said. He's sleeping now. He's very sick, you know.
Jody nodded in the car, opened and closed her spare hand in frustration.
Mrs. Hobie, can't you tell us what this is about?
Silence, breathing, thinking.
I should let my husband tell you. I think he can explain it better than me. It's a long story, and I sometimes get confused.
Okay, when will he wake up? Jody asked. Should we come by a little later? There was another pause.
He usually sleeps right through after his medication, the old woman said. It's a blessing, really, I think. Can your father's friend come first thing in the morning?